no, nadie se salva. Pienso que esto empieza primero una presidencia. Mientras sigan con lo mismo sus agencias, la balacera será la consecuencia. Ay, todos dicen que sí.
Ignition. We have liftoff. Out and about is a go. All systems are nominal. Hey, welcome out and abouters. You are listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane on 88.1 or 92.3 FM. Maybe you may be streaming from KYRS.org. Maybe. Who knows? Hey, welcome today. And it is finally a snowy day in Spokane. And I have my guest with me here today, Jordan Sermonera. Now, I hope I pronounced that correctly.
That is an acceptable pronunciation.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Give me the real pronunciation.
Well, if you want to be insufferably as Italian as my father, it's Cerminara, but I can't.
Oh, Cerminara.
I can't do that.
Oh, I can do that. I'm going to do it.
If you want to.
Cerminara.
I was raised in Kansas, so I say Sermonera.
Yeah. They make the deep, not Chicago does the deep dish pizza, right?
Yeah, just Pizza Hut. I think Kansas is
you guys
well
ever have Shakey's there?
No Shakey's. The first Pizza Hut ever was in Kansas.
Really?
It was in Wichita.
It's kind of a survivor, you know?
Yeah, it really is as not good as it is.
I mean, I worked 6 years working my way through college at Denny's.
Okay.
I was a Denny's cook.
Yeah.
And some people would say I was a chef because I wore a chef's hat, but I wasn't really a chef.
Yeah.
But I was a Denny's cook.
I don't know. If you can make moons over my hammy with your eyes closed.
It wasn't even a thing yet.
Oh, it wasn't a thing.
I was pre-Grand Slam. I was there when the Grand Slam rolled out.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. A little history for those of you who are keeping score at home. Hey, before we get started talking about what you're doing, I've been doing this thing every week, and I'm going to try to segue this, hopefully. I've been doing reading from On Tyranny, Timothy Snyder's, not really reading from it, but summarizing. Last week we had Do Not Obey in Advance, and then that was a tough segue. And then this week we're saying Defend Institutions, and we're seeing institutions under attack right now. I mean, big time.
Not Pizza Hut.
Not Pizza Hut, right? I mean, Pizza the Hut, maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe. But so far, you know, we've been seeing Trump consolidating all this power and out of the legislative branch and holding the purse strings. But I'm here to remind you that there are also other institutions that you should spend your time in and put your hope in. And that's our state governments and our local city government. And then also, hey, KYRS. I mean, we are an institution. We are part of the press. We're doing our thing here. And also, let's talk about the institution of comedy.
Hey, that's why I'm here. Great segue.
Yeah, thank you. It was a little rough.
It's okay.
But
I really enjoyed it.
I think I stuck the landing.
Yeah, no, you did.
So I went online to research you because I didn't have much time.
Sure.
You know, and a lot of confusing stuff out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have some of your bits I'm going to play, if that's okay.
That's absolutely fine.
If that's okay.
Sure.
I don't want to give anything away.
Yeah, whatever.
I don't want people yelling the punchline out of you. Nobody needs that.
I think there's such a minimal amount of my comedy actually online. I think if they did it, it would be maybe once or twice in a 45-minute set. So it'll be okay.
Yeah. You know, that's good. That's probably the right amount of participation.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in a lot of the things you're doing. Mm-hmm. I'm interested, number one, you're doing a show at the Garland. You want to talk? Let's talk about that. That's what you're really
here. So back in September of 2023 was the first time that I ever came to Spokane, and I actually recorded my first stand-up album there at the Garland, and it was great. It was a really great experience. So I'm super nostalgic for this place that I have such a interesting connection with. I mean, it was, you know, 10 to 11 years in the making at that point, as far as how long I'd been pursuing stand-up. So to perform to so many, like, the crowd in Spokane was great. I stood out on the corner for like a week with a handmade sign and was very much like playing with traffic while the lights were stopped. I was waving at people and like, read my sign, come to the show on Thursday. Okay. And about 300 people turned out. But that was September and it was warm. And I realized that Spokane is very cold this time of year and not so responsive to the signing on the corner this weekend as much as I would have liked the memory of that to be fresh in the Garland District's mind. I don't know that anyone cares.
Well, people might be in a little bit of bad moods, too, right? I mean, people are kind of in a bad mood, and then the snow, and then you're out there waving at them.
Yeah.
They've had enough.
I've had a few people do some really sweet things, and bringing a few smiles to people's faces and getting, like, some direct marketing in that way. But the show is, and that's one of the reasons that I'm here, the show is this Thursday at 7:30 at the Garland Theater. I'm working out a new hour of material that I am set to record in San Francisco in September of this year. So,
oh, very cool.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. It's all different material. If you're happening to be listening at this very moment and you remember who I am, I am doing completely different material than the last time you saw me, and I'm so excited to share it with Spokane.
Yeah. Now you have, there is a bit of collage. Now is that your collage? There's a reference to collage in that. Are you, is your collage, is there going to be like slideshows of your collage?
You know, I am working up to something like that one of these days. Hopefully I can find a little bit more of like a niche audience where that would make sense to people who are intentionally coming to see me rather than where I'm currently at, where like, you know, people will turn out, but they don't necessarily know who I am.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's something down the road for when I actually find my true audience and, you know, people are buying tickets to actually come see me. I might work with some multimedia stuff on stage, but I have made collage art since I was a kid. My mom went to art school in the 90s when everything was kind of by hand. So had a lot of art processes kind of at my hands. And that was the thing I always gravitated towards. And I've worked in a lot of different mediums, but through the years, I was kind of like doing too many different types of humor creation to where I really didn't feel like I had my brand dialed in.
Yeah.
And coming into that first recording of what I was like, what is an hour of my comedy like? I was really finding myself like, I think that out of all the art that I make, collage brings me the most joy. And so I really kind of leaned into this branding of like, I've switched everything to like hand cut comedy. That's my like kind of branding. Cut. And I post a lot of my collage art, and I've been making a lot of like process videos and things like that where I'm doing something like, you know, like a goofy voiceover or maybe pairing the image that's being created with a stand-up bit, like kind of split screens like that. Yeah. So I'm just trying to find like a niche audience. I feel like the people that I've known through the years that have done really well for themselves, they have something that's maybe not relatable to everyone, but so relatable to like a very distinct group that's where I feel like you can start figuring out like, oh, lots of people in city X like me and I can go there and sell tickets because that's really what people just want, to work with people who can fill a venue.
Right. And you know, Terry Gilliam, Monty Python, reminded me of that a lot.
I really admire the Monty Python like stop motion animation with those collage elements and a lot of their sequences. Such a cool thing. And I do remember that like pretty vividly from my childhood.
Yeah. And you know, you could also really whip out probably a really good ransom note.
Yeah,
that's good.
That's one of my favorite things. It's kind of one of the bits that I've been working out recently. I always try to like in a long form set and in these concepts of like what an album is. Since I have leaned into this branding, I feel like I owe it to that to like have some kind of a collage oriented bit.
Yeah,
which I had one in my first album that it did well for me, and then it challenged me to like, okay, what's a new perspective on making collage that's relatable? And a lot of times, I sell prints of my collage art after shows.
Oh, that's cool.
And so a lot of times people will come up to me and, you know, they'll look at my art and, you know, say things like, wow, better than I expected or something like that. You know, it's really sweet. But there's always like, it's not every show, but after I've kind of talked about it in a set and then I'm selling it afterward, every now and then, like some schmarmy person comes up to me and they like look at my art and then they're like, collage art, huh? Are you like a serial killer? And I'm like, that's where you're confused. Okay. At no point in American pop culture have serial killers been affiliated with collage art. It's no, kidnappers.
It's kidnappers.
Yeah. Yeah. Terrorists. Yeah. You know, it's yeah. a different ball game. Okay.
It is. That must be a little insulting, and also insulting that if you were a serial killer, would you just go, oh, you got me. Dang it.
Well, and then to me, it's like kind of like, are you sure you're not this year? Is this some overt like, let's push off my antics?
Or maybe just reaching out.
Yeah.
Like wanting, you know.
A community, trying to find a community.
A community of serial killers.
I think it's just one of those things that's interesting as far as like the similarities between like a collage artist and a kidnapper. You know, it's a hard business and you know it's going to take like extreme measures to get someone to look at my art, you know?
You know how many times when somebody's doing like this kidnapping note, they get ready to send it and like one of the other kidnappers say, you know, you forgot the O in hostage. It makes no sense.
And you can't go back and cross it out.
You got to cut out all new letters.
Start from scrap.
Yeah. And speaking of which, so is there, when you're a collage artist, is there kind of a tendency to kind of slip into the darker side of like scrapbooking? Or can you just stay pure?
I feel like my whole point of making collage, it's like, I don't make art like some people do where it's like, this is what I think about the war. Yeah. And you know, like I'm not interested in making art with necessarily a statement. My goal is to always just kind of make something that is a goof and it'll invoke some kind of like, that's stupid. You know,
I would imagine too, as you're cutting out letters that, just that the mechanics of doing that and looking at these letters, that there's probably some other thing that comes out of that and you just completely turn on a dime and go another direction.
Most of the art that I make, I don't do a ton of lettering unless there's like something specific. Like if I'm making like a flyer or something like that, I might go out of my way to do lettering. I did for the album that I recorded at the Garland back in 2023, I did press that on vinyl and I did all of the cover art. I did like a gatefold jacket.
Oh, cool.
And I did all the lettering for the tracks on the back with hand cut letters. And so that's like something that I would do lettering for most of the time. I'm not a big fan of like, and it's not just in collage art. I don't like art with words on it.
Yeah.
I feel like I like artists that lean on imagery to invoke thoughts and feelings. Yeah. Whereas when there's a word in there, it feels like I'm being pushed to like be told what this is about.
Yeah.
Rather than like, oh, let me just take this images and then I can give it some own meaning for myself.
Yeah.
But once you start putting language in it, it's just, it's not a complete turn off for me. Some people do it really tastefully, but for my personal aesthetic and the things that I like to make, I usually leave lettering out of it, but I do meticulously cut things out. I try to make them look really seamless.
Yeah.
It's a challenge for me.
I think you're that vid. I saw the one where the kid's head's popping out of the, it was like out of a shovel, and there's two guys talking, like, I'm a boy.
I like that
one a lot. You know, this, just not to get stuck on the lettering and the artwork, but one of the things that I've been doing as far as thrift store art, and it's hard to find now, you know, those blackboards that say, you know, live, love, laugh, or in our family, we believe these things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what I've been doing is getting these, and then I paint out enough words so they kind of make sense, but they really don't.
Yeah.
There's something like, if you look at them, they'd be, what does that even mean?
Uh-huh.
You know, and then I paint a picture on them in acrylic that has nothing to do with it at all.
That's fun.
So when people are like looking like they're struggling, like, I don't know what this means. I'm lost. And then they reach out for this picture, this painting, and it's like a dog eating spaghetti. They're gone.
Yeah.
They're completely gone.
In this house, we believe in very weird things.
Yeah. I had one about on this farm. and we do this, we do love, we do that, we that. And then I haven't done this one yet, but it's on this farm, we do animals. That's what it's going to say.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, I'll paint like a rocket ship on it, uh-huh, or something. Now, why did you go with the garland instead of like going with the comedy club?
I think for me at the time, initially, I have a good friend of mine who's a producer, and he has the means to like kind of make it happen for me in the sense. And we were initially going to record in Los Angeles, and his team, like, it was just like a failure to kind of lock down the venue that we had kind of like, I think it'll work good here. And I was headlining a handful of rooms leading up to that date where they were larger spaces. And so it was between the garland and two other spots. And I was looking for something that would look good on film.
Oh yeah.
You know, and the garland's just such a beautiful little space, and
it's very Portland-esque.
I really like the garland a lot, and not just like the theater itself. It was about, you know, the guy who's running the comedy shows there every first Thursday, Josiah Carlson. He's a real nice dude. And he was super helpful in setting it up and helping it be a successful show. And also the staff, Jasmine, one of the owners there, and her whole staff of bartenders and the folks that work the front counter. They're just all super sweet people. And yeah, I felt super welcome there. And I spent a good week around a lot of these, and they were just, I have such sentimental feelings.
Oh, that makes me feel really good.
Around the Garland Theater. Come back is great.
That's cool. And that neighborhood's cool too.
Yeah.
There's a bookstore that I really like down the way.
To the record store?
Yeah. Maybe a little bit further on, because then you've got like Time Bomb,
uh-huh,
down there, and then it's a kind of kitty corner from Time Bomb.
Okay.
Giant Nerd Books.
Okay.
And they've got just a great, I went in there because I was looking for old Mad magazines.
Uh-huh.
And I missed the giant bin. I'm like, do you have any old Mad magazines? They're like, yeah, right.
We have all of them.
Yeah, we're right there. Yeah. I'm like, I was looking for some replacements. But they have everything at this place. It's just a fantastic, I love that block. I mean,
yeah,
that one block is sort of like, or maybe two or three blocks.
It's, yeah,
like you're in Portland almost.
It's a very cutesy little art. And that's, yeah, I think one of the things that they're meeting about right now, there's an event tonight. It's that Jasmine, one of the co-owners over there at the Garland, she's attending, and it's something to get the Garland district as like a creative arts district or something. They're trying to like get some more funding around the space and like kind of keeping the Garland like the Garland is. And I'm not 100% sure on all the details of it, but I'm going there later tonight to promote the show.
Okay.
And try and get some more people who are in the space who might be able to spread the word.
And this is a big part. I mean, kind of the nuts and bolts of doing comedy, right? Is you kind of have to be out there working it too, right? I mean, you just,
I don't know that everybody does, but I this is my, like, I don't know. I think comedy was like my plan C, you know, and
what was plan A?
I don't know. I just figure it out. You know, it was just like, it'll come to me, you know, like it was just a lot of wasting time. I didn't start doing stand up until I was like 26. So okay. I definitely had some like lost years of just like floating, you know, and thinking I was going to be like a musician or something, or something else, you know, just not what this ended up being. But I've been a lifelong goofball, you know, I was like a class clown archetype, you know. And so but I'm from Kansas, so the opportunity to like get on stage is not something that's really common where I'm from.
Yeah.
And the first time I ever did an open mic was a very happenstance situation. I lived in a college town. There was one comedy open mic a month at a bar I'd been to a million times before, and I'd lived there for 7-8 years and never had seen this happen. And then I was like there, and I watched some people that I'd known for years not do well on stage, and I was like, well, I could do that not well, you know.
Yes.
And I had a great time, and within about 3 months I had like sold everything and was headed for the West Coast. Just found my calling, you know?
That's a great way to live your life. And
it's felt like, I don't know, I mean, it's difficult, and it is like what you're saying, like it should be that way for most comedians. I feel like a lot of people don't look at comedy as a business for a while, like for a little too long, but I've always looked at it like, this is what I want to do, and I'm trying to do as many things as I can to make it work. Like, no one knows who I am. So no one's like, if I showed up on Thursday and wasn't here for a few days, I would know that I didn't do everything that I could to try and put some people in that space.
Yeah.
And I don't like not putting all of myself into something like that. You know, it's a big space, and I don't know if you've ever been on stage and performed to a very small crowd in a very large room, but it's a very awkward feeling.
It is. Yeah.
And so I know that it'll probably be a smaller turnout than the last time, but I also didn't have as much time as a different time of year. You know, that standing on the corner with the sign, it's done at about 5:30. It's about pitch black dark at 5:30.
Yeah,
now.
It is.
And the commute over there is like, it's from 3 to 6. Like it's a very short window of when there's even traffic in that general area.
That's very true.
So it's been a lot less like feeling like I have been able to do much, but I am doing everything that I can to try and put some folks in there. So.
All right. Well, we got to break here for a little bit and play some stuff. This is kind of a new deal, because we're going to be doing my underwriting messages. This is groundbreaking as a recording. Usually I do them live.
And okay.
This is going to be, I'm kind of excited.
I'm stoked for you.
Yeah, me too. This is going to be so cool. And then we're going to come back. But before we do that, why don't we let people know again, when's the show and how can they get tickets? Can they just show up?
If you go to my social media at Handcut Comedy, you will be able to find your way to a ticket link. And if you want to take an easier route, you could probably just type in the Garland Theater Comedy, and it'll probably take you to an Eventbrite link. My name's Jordan Sermonera. You'll see it there. Other details, handcutcomedy.com or at Handcut Comedy on all social media. The show is this Thursday, the 6th at 7:30 at the Garland
That's
Theater.
That's day after tomorrow for those of you who
listening live.
Are listening live, yeah. And so, we're going to come back. I've got a lot of questions I haven't even gotten started to ask you, so we'll do that. And everybody, just please stay tuned. Why don't you?
Hey there, folks. Join me for a musical trip along Americana Avenue. Now on Wednesday evenings from 6 to 8 p.m. Hear the greatest progressive songwriters from yesterday and today. Each week, I'll feature a specific artist and a vinyl spin of the week. It's music that plays to the human condition.
Let's do
Wednesdays at 6 on Thin Air Community Radio.
Because that was from the first. Yeah. Okay, cool. Awesome,
yeah. KYRS exists because of the support of the public. We thank you for giving a little back with
I think
sustaining
Apple Music
monthly
is
support
a streaming
to continue
thing, so it's
independent music,
numbers,
local interest,
like
and progressive news
and
programming that is refreshing,
it's,
engaging,
I'm trying
and
to
helps
get it
expand
picked up
perspective.
By SiriusXM right
Just
now,
text
so.
Give KYRS
get
to 44321 and help keep KYRS on the air.
Minuscule returns, like cents. But
KYRS listeners know the importance of investments. Make a wise investment in your company. Invest in KYRS listeners as your customers by becoming a KYRS program sponsor. Call 509-624-7573.
Out and About receives support from the Northwest Museum of Arts and Culture. The MAC presents Samurai, Sunrise, Sunset through June 1st, 2025. This exhibition features armor, weaponry, and personal items of Japan's samurai class. Located at 2316 West 1st Avenue in Spokane's historic Browns Edition, more information is available at northwestmuseum.org. Out and About receives support from Boots Bakery and Lounge, specializing in vegan bistro fare and gluten-free baked goods. Located in the Saranac Commons, 19 West Main Street in Spokane. Open 7 a.m. through 7 p.m. Monday through Saturday, 7 a.m. through 5 p.m. Sundays. Full menu and information at bootsbakery.com. And we're back, and I think all that worked. It sounded like it went out there, and we did our thing. So we're going to – I'm here right now with Jordan Sermonera, who is a stand-up from Portland. Oh, hang on. Turn up the headphone for you a little bit. a stand-up from Portland. And do you prefer comic stand-up? What do you like?
You know, I think I refer to myself as a comic more often than not, but yeah.
Okay,
it doesn't bother me either way. Stand-up is the same thing. I do stand-up comedy.
But you're a stand-up comic.
Yeah.
From Portland. And we're going to play, Jordan's got bits on, I found these on Apple Music, but you can find them and you can go, I think, can you buy the CD
If you go to my website, handcutcomedy.com, there are ways where you can find all different versions of the first album that I recorded live here at the Garland Theater in September of 2023. You can either buy them if you want to support me in that way. I've got it currently on audio, and there's also streaming versions. And I have a vinyl record as well. So if you're into collecting vinyl, I designed all the cover art myself with hand cut collage, and it's on clear vinyl. I will also have copies of it at the show on the 6th this week, Thursday, 7:30 at the Garland Theater. Come out, snag one. The entire album from the first one is online right now if you want to hear some of my comedy before you decide to come out. And I think we're going to listen to a little now, right?
Yes, we are. This bit's called Not So Macho Man.
Kind of a dork across the board. In my spare time, I make analog collage art. If you don't know what that is, that means I take old magazines like Life and National Geographic and I cut out disparate images and rearrange them into funny little pictures that make me laugh. because I cannot afford therapy. Yeah. Pretty wild. The only thing that's got me holding on is a pair of scissors. I'm fine. With that said, anytime I need some space to myself, don't want to be bothered, I know no one will disturb me in the men's bathroom at Joanne Fabrics and Crafts. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've never actually seen another human being in the men's bathroom at Joanne Fabrics and Crafts. I have a hard time at this point accessing my masculinity. Mostly because I live in Portland. It's illegal there now. I do think we need to give the elder millennials a little bit of a break in the toxic masculinity conversation. Because the types of things that were being shown to me about what it meant to be a man as a young boy, very confusing, all right? All of my fellow boy buddies when I was a kid, they made it uncomfortably clear to me that it was no longer acceptable to have a stuffed animal. While simultaneously, it was actually considered cool to own a pillow that was shaped like a WWF wrestler. I confront my friend about it. I'd be like, that's just a stuffed animal, right? He's like, no, it's a half-naked dude that I spoon while I sleep. And that kid was wild, man. He was so aggressive, he would get real hateful with his mom before bedtime when I'd stay over at his house, you know. Start yelling at her, like, listen up, mother. Tonight, I'm going to bed with the macho man. And you ain't got to worry about nothing, mother, because this ain't no sissy stuffed animal. You can tell by his nipples. Oh, yeah. From the top bunk. Kid was a savage.
There we have some Jordan Cervenera talking about Not So Macho Man.
That's it.
And
so weird to listen to myself on a live radio show.
I know. It's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you, I listening to your stuff, you kind of remind me of Maria Bamford.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Guys, that's a compliment.
Yeah,
what a wonderful comedian.
Oh, my gosh. One of my favorites.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe my favorite.
She's great.
Yeah. But, I mean, that is sort of like the absurdism of the everyday.
Yeah.
You know?
Totally. I mean, I try to make my comedy as, like, accessible as I can. I know I have a very, like, narrowed experience and who I am as a person, but it's like I don't get any joy out of I know a lot of comedians that like really enjoy making people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I don't get anything out of that. I have always been very in my social life, just very diplomatic. And yeah. I want everybody to feel, you know, fine yes. and welcome and like not in a place where they have to like get angry or get upset or whatever. It's like, it's just about getting some silly giggles out. Right. So I try to make it as accessible as I can, which maybe I play it too safe. You know, maybe I don't take enough like steadfast opinions in certain spaces to like garner more of an engaged like, oh, well, there's the joke. Okay. You know, like, I don't know. I really don't enjoy the idea of like a whole crowd turning on me because of what I've decided to talk about today.
Yeah. Is there a point when, you know, and I suppose probably like when you're trying out new material where you have something that you're going to say that is funny to you? And this is what I think I would have a problem with stand up, because I think if I thought something was funny and the crowd didn't laugh, I would think it was even more funny.
Yeah. And you know,
that would be a problem. I think
it is really interesting to have gone through the process of like, you know, writing out in my head a long form set list that first time of like, what is this? And I'm really like, I'm about like, I like to write with continuity and flow, and I want things to not feel disparate. I really enjoy yeah. the challenge of like, how do I patchwork this? How do I collage all of my jokes together,
oh my
you
gosh.
Know, yeah. and make it all kind of a coherent thing that seems like it's coming from the same voice, from the same person, you yeah. know, and that, and segues and things like, just like yeah. it's, but segues that aren't like, so speaking of this, like just something that kind of naturally leads into of like, now we're here, you know, and it feels seamless and like yeah. unforced. And so that challenge with what you're talking about, where there's like, there's so many lines in my writing that I just think are so funny to me. And it was really funny to know, like, most of that material was formed in like the 2 years leading up to it. Some of those jokes were jokes that I've been telling for a very long time. Sure. It was the first thing I ever recorded, you know? So some of those jokes were 8 years old, you yeah. know? But I had these lines in there, and in the editing process and like paring it down, and you know, you can, I did an hour and 5 minutes at the theater, but when I was going to press it on vinyl, it's like, you can only put 44 minutes on right. a record. Right. So having to like put stuff on the cutting floor, and some of these lines that I'd been saying for years, where I'm just like, instead of going, maybe we should like tweak that sentence a little bit since it gets nothing every time you say it. But for me, it's like, this is how I colored my writing. It's so smart and clever. And it's like, yeah, yeah. but it doesn't evoke laughter.
Yeah.
Like,
that's what you're kind of after. Right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. yeah that's got to be really, how have you seen your comedy evolve from when you started?
Having the foresight now to know that the goal of the next recording is to be more in tune with that concept of like, okay, we know we really like this line, but no one else does. So either rewrite it,
yeah.
rework it, push it somewhere else, like find something that elicits more laughter, or there's no reason that you need to record this to turn it into some weird editing situation for an audio engineer to have to deal with.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like, just be better, you know? And so yeah. I think it's given me a lot more spaciousness with my work to be able to look at it objectively, like, okay, let's imagine that the audience isn't exactly like you and your weird little brain
yeah.
and try and reach more people and keep the clip up, like keep the laughs going, you know, like don't, if you're feeling a dullness in a space, there's something there to be worked on. And so I've worked a lot harder on this new hour of material, and I still have a while to figure it out. And like, honestly, I think I've only ran the full 45 minute to an hour set that I'm going to be doing this Thursday at the Garland at 7:30. I think I've only ran it about 6 or 7 times, but I have about 25 bookings right now between February and March. And I haven't started booking anything beyond that, but the goal is to record in September. So
yeah.
I have a lot of good work ahead of me, and I feel like I'm more focused than I was the first time, where I was more nervous about just being able to cover the time.
Yeah.
And now it's opened up like the ability to write material so much more for me now that I got that off my chest.
Yeah. Right. And do you feel like, I know like in doing plays and stuff that you're up there, I mean, I'm up there on the stage, and then sometimes things hit with an audience the same. You feel like you're delivering it the same way.
Oh, yeah.
And the, but the audience day to day. Is different that night. Uh-huh. There's just a whole different vibe to it.
It's one of the most interesting things of performance. Yeah. It's every performance is different. You can deliver it just the same, and it just brought the house down. And then you just have a – could be the same number of people.
Yeah.
And maybe even the same space, you know, but for some reason – you're not capturing those. It's just not the same energy. It's a whole new collection of people. And so it's an interesting challenge that I do enjoy for the most part until I really feel like I can't feel into what the problem is if they arise, you know, where I'm like, man, really not connecting with this audience. I can tell pretty immediately if I'm not connecting with an audience, and I'll adjust a little bit. Like, oh, let's get into the like crazy animated stuff like faster. Let's get into the stuff where it's like,
okay,
they can see that like I have material that like is going to show them more than what I've given them maybe for the first 3 or 4 minutes. If I'm not getting some good hearty laughs off of the first 4 or 5 jokes, it's like, okay, it's time to switch gears and like let them know that I'm a performer.
And that's probably something that you've developed over the years. It's probably something you didn't see right off the bat, right?
It's kind of one of those things where the more tools you have and like the more parts of yourself that you understand as a comedic performer, you have the ability to kind of like slow. It feels slow. It like on stage, it's like, I've honestly gotten to a really big problem lately where I feel so competent in covering time that I'm not good at gauging time anymore. And like, you know, I was supposed to do 20 and I did 32.
Oh, sure.
Like, producers don't like that.
Well, do you have to open? Are you do many openers? Are you an opener for people at all?
I don't open for anybody famous. I have opened for some like very notable comedians, but not at the request of like them or their management. You know, it's just like kind of happenstance.
And I always wondered about that. So when you're doing Midland or opening, do you have to like... do you have to like look at what their act is and then sort of like figure out how you're going to either set the stage for them or contrast with them? Or
one thing you would hope that's happening there is that the person who books you is being mindful about that.
Yeah.
Where it's like either someone who is complimentary to the style of the headliner or someone who isn't going to step on the headliner's toes.
Yeah.
Like, there are definitely people in the Pacific Northwest who I feel like don't like working with me because I have a very high, like I wouldn't let me open for a headliner who has similar energy to me.
Right.
Because it's like, oh, that's my shtick is that I'm like, I do a lot of sing-songy stuff. I do a lot of impressions.
Right.
And I sell them and I'm like, I'll get really animated, you know, and it's not that there's just some people that I feel like our styles get so similar that they're like, I don't want to follow him, which I aspire to do stuff like that. But I also don't want to make anybody else's life harder. So for me, that's like, that's the producer of the show's job to not like, you either feature me for someone who, I mean, like is just a killer deadpan person that really has, and that style's, I think, the hardest style to really nail because it's so low energy. If the joke writing isn't like crisp and just really dialed in, you're not going to get the laughs that you want to get.
Oh, because you have to have, everybody has to be paying attention.
Yeah, totally. You know? You really have to be dialed in. And sometimes like even when my jokes are like maybe not the strongest jokes, I sell them so hard that it's like people are like, oh, it's funny, right?
My favorite joke of yours so far that I've heard that we really can't say here has to do with, let's say, sexual acts while driving.
Ah, yes, yes.
And I loved that.
The misdirection, turn. Yes.
Yeah, that was really, I thought, oh, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
It was really good.
Thank you. Yeah. That joke definitely served me very well for a while, and I was using it as a closer for a long time. And that's been a challenge, too. It's like, I really, at this point, I just thought of something the other night that I'm considering using as a closer for this more long form set that I'm currently working out now. But I had such a good closer for the album that we've been talking about, Cutting It Up, alive on all streaming platforms. And you can purchase it on Apple and Amazon Music. I had such a good closer for that I really enjoyed. And I just don't have anything that like kind of matches that level of something that's well written. It's goofy. It's kind of based in a little reality, but it gets so absurd and it's just fun. Like, it was just such a fun joke to tell. And it was a great way to close that album. And I used that as a closer for a long time. But in shorter sets, I was using the joke that you're talking about a lot. Because it was just like one that I knew if it was like a little, you know, a late night show. If we're doing a 9:30, 10 o'clock show, you know, the dirtier the better for most people and audiences that come out for that. Yeah. Not a super crass or dirty comic.
No, really no. And that's right. I think that's so smart because that one caught me off guard because the stuff I was listening to was, you know, it was like the Not So Macho Man.
Yeah.
You know, it was kind of.
Talking about kids' toys and very, like child age experiences.
That one came out of the flu. And I was like, first of all, it's just a little disarming. And then, like you said, the misdirection was, I just thought so wonderful.
And I think positioning myself in that space of that joke specifically is that, like, I've led you up to this point to know that, like, I'm a complete dork. So in this particular scenario, I mean, I'm not prudent, but I'm definitely not like somebody who's like extremely on the other side of that.
Right.
So to be overwhelmed by someone who is like, you're like, oh, I'm such a little goofball in this space. I wouldn't know what to do here.
It really kind of reminded me of like an Emo Phillips.
Such a hilarious act.
Again, a favorite.
Yeah.
A favorite as well. Do you kind of find that audiences are kind of different in different places? I mean, as far as locales like Spokane versus Portland, are people sort of
people are people. And again, like for shows being like different from venue to venue and event to event, like every night's different no matter what. And I have been completely surprised by what people found funny in a place where I had kind of like judged the area of wherever I might be performing, like, oh, they're probably going to be more conservative or more liberal or, you know, whatever. And like performing in Portland, it's like Portland gets a rap for being like extremely left, but, you know, most extremely left people in Portland aren't the people that own all the homes, you know? Yes. So there's a pretty broad scope of, it just depends like what part of town you're in. And like, I mean, if you go outside of Portland, like 30, 45 minutes, you might as well be in Kansas, you know? So it's, and which like for me, there's a lot of people, especially in the Portland, people can be kind of militant about like not wanting to perform for, you know, people that don't believe every single thing that they believe. And for me, it's like, I grew up in Kansas, you know, like these are people to me that are just like, they're just folks. And like, and again, I have a couple things that I'm doing right now where it's like, I do like an Obama impression in one of my jokes and it's, I feel like a really good impression and it's from a place of absurdity. Like the scenario that's been painted where I'm doing this impression, it's a summation of my mom's trajectory of like having graduated from art school in the early 90s and then being taken out of the job market due to advancements in technology. Like she got a degree right before Adobe Photoshop was invented.
Oh.
So then I like set up the scenario where I'm doing an Obama speech where he's talking about my mom's life. And then the punchline is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, you know, like getting Obama to say Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is just like, and I get it's funny because I get mixed reactions in Portland. Like a lot of people look at me and be like, he shouldn't be doing this voice. And for me, it's like, it's a voice of a former standing president.
Yeah.
And then like, if you can't like impersonate one of the highest politicians that, you know, you can be in America, then it's like, okay, like this isn't a race thing and neither was the speech. Like, it's just like, it's such a goofy thing.
Yeah.
And then different room, same city, crushes.
Oh, I bet.
And then I love to finish saying that with, you know, something to the effect of, I miss when everybody's clapping and applauding. I'm like, I miss when the president can finish a sentence too, you know, and that'll get a really nice reaction in Portland. But if you do that in like, you know, Medford, it's not as exactly received, but I can play both sides. I can be like, you know, I really miss that old war criminal, that well-spoken war criminal. Like, but if you say something like, if you call Obama a well-spoken war criminal in Portland, they turn on you immediately.
Yeah.
They're like, no, you don't down talk that.
Right.
And it's like
knowing your crowd.
Yeah. It's one of those things of like a little pandery of like, how am I tagging this joke up to kind of like get out and get to the next thing. But the crowds are, they're different everywhere.
Yeah. But you mostly avoid political humor.
I really do. And
is that just because it's so, I mean, to me, it seems like it doesn't last as long.
Exactly. There's no shelf life to it.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I think the novelty, like in my first album, I did an impression of Bill Clinton, you know?
Yeah. Oh, you did. Yes, I heard that.
Because it was about like the DARE program. I received a letter from President Bill Clinton when I was 10 years old after getting the DARE medal or something. And then I, you know, I make up this letter that I did. There was a real thing. I don't know what it said, but
you didn't,
like,
start out saying, hey, buddy.
Hey, buddy. Yeah. Just doing that. And like, it's the novelty of just doing a voice that like people are familiar with. Did Bill Clinton even sound like that? No, but the caricature of him.
Oh, Christopher Walken. That's the thing. If you're going to be an impressionist, do you have to like know, you have to kind of go for like what the impression is.
Yeah, exactly. It's really like a caricature of a voice.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and I get a lot of joy from just like taking a time out of like, I'm not doing my voice right now. I don't want to.
Yeah.
I want to play. I like my voice as a tool.
Yeah.
And I think more so through that experience of making the first album, it really led me to go like, that's one of your talents. That's one of the things that sets you apart. So lean into that. And now I will find reasons to do voices that are like vast, because I do have a pretty good range of like the types of voices that I can do.
Yeah, you do have a good range. And I think too that, I don't know, when I'm telling stories just to my friends, I'll use different voices.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
It's a fun way to paint a conversation.
And that's what always got me in trouble is doing impressions of the teachers.
Me too, yeah.
Yeah, it kind of cost me a job in the Air Force, but, you know, I've always had really bad impulse control. So, but, you know, I was going to ask you about your friends in Portland. Do you find that, do you have a community of fellow comics that you kind of sound things off of, or do you kind of like want to just separate yourself from that when it's time to do the work?
I did my first 7-8 years of comedy in San Francisco.
Okay.
And my longest standing comedy relationships with people that I feel closest to are people that I knew in the Bay Area who are all over the place at this point, and there's very few of them. I do serve it as work more than as a community. I feel like a lot of people do use comedy as a community, which is great. Good for you. I'm glad that, but I've gotten to this point where like, I'm kind of edging on 40 at this point. Yeah. And I like just moved to the Portland scene like a few years ago, and comedy at the lowest levels, like amateur comedy, when you're just starting out and you're doing a lot of open mics and stuff like that, it's a real young person's game. And I'm at an age where it just feels weird to try and get the approval of people in their mid-20s.
Yes.
And like really make them like and want to like be my friend, because I just have so little capacity for like true social interaction anymore if it's not with people that I have like really well-founded like friendships with.
Yeah.
And it's just because there's not any time anymore. I spent so much time as a younger person wasting time.
Yeah.
And I have, since I started doing comedy, I feel like I've been playing catch up. And now it's like, I'm kind of obsessed with work, with like trying to make this work.
Well, how did you get to Portland? What was,
So during the pandemic, I was living in the Bay Area with a woman that I had dated for a number of years. And that person was not interested in living in the Bay Area when we started dating, like 3 or 4 years before that. And I had moved there intentionally to do stand up. And so I was actually, to bring up thrift store art again, I was, I produce a comedy show with my best friend where we curate thrift store art. We have comedians make fun of it.
I love that videos too.
And then we auction it off at the end.
Yeah,
and
very cool idea.
Locally in San Francisco, leading up to the pandemic, we had a pretty decent cult following, and we would sell a 60-person room out like a couple weeks before the show would even happen. We got a lot of news attention, and we were running it in a few other cities regionally. And in 2020, we were set to do 24 shows in 10 cities across Northern California and the Bay Area. And the second show of the year and the last show of the year, a talent agent from an LA agency had intentionally come to the show and was like, afterwards was like, hey, we
I saw your show. I saw about your show and I came to see it and I really like it. Do you guys have representation? And it was like, nope. Do you want it? Yep. And we immediately started conversations about filming a screener to pitch a pilot with their representation. And so had set it all up, got a technical director. This was February 17th or something like that of 2020. And like within a couple weeks had it all lined up to film it at the Punchline in San Francisco, contracts and all that stuff. And then before our March show, everything shut down. And so I was hemorrhaging $1,750 a month in a one bedroom apartment with my partner. And after the date that we had set, it was July 7th of 2020, where we were supposed to film a thing, after that had passed, and it just like, there was still no clarity. It's like, are we ever going to perform again? And I just was kind of at a loss because all that stuff was just kind of falling apart.
Yeah.
And I told her like, hey, we can go wherever you want. And we decided to move to the Portland area. And so we moved there in October of 2020. And by April of 2021, I was moving out and we had split up.
Oh, no.
So I threw all my stuff in storage and I drove it. This is a lot about what the last 20 minutes of the first album is. It's like that kind of lost my job, lost my significant relationship, was more or less stranded in an unfamiliar area. During the pandemic. Yeah. And threw all my stuff in storage and I drove across the lower 48 states and I visited every state for about a year and a half.
Wow.
And that's where a lot of my... it made me double down. Like I was like, you know, you kind of moved yourself away from where you intentionally went to do the thing that you changed your life for the first time.
Yeah.
And you did it for like someone else's needs.
Right.
And so I was like, you know, this is what I want to do. And so that was what the beginning of the focus of like, I have an hour of material and I need to figure out how to get it on.
Yeah.
Get it recorded, get it in the bucket and on to the next, because this is what I'm going to do. And my goal right now is to record a new hour of material every 2 years.
Oh, that's great.
So, and that's until I die. That's the plan.
Well, I hope you have many hours.
Me
ahead
too.
Of you.
Yeah.
What's your process like? Do you sit down and go, okay, I'm going to work now, I'm going to write stuff, or do you kind of wait for something to hit you, or a combo?
I try, and that's another reason why I don't really like involve myself in the quote unquote community. Mm-hmm. I don't spend a lot of time at open mics anymore. I did 12 open mics a week for years in San Francisco. And I pretty much know when you're performing at an open mic, you're mostly performing to other comedians. Yeah. So it's not, after a certain while, once you've got your like confidence and your chops on stage, it's a completely different thing. Like I was a class clown and a show off and a joker and a storyteller my whole life. But translating that from a group of people that trust and know that you're funny and like that they expect you to be funny, and then to do it to like blind audiences, it's a completely different skill set.
Yeah.
And so once you actually have that dialed in and you can kind of read an audience and do that, and then kind of find yourself being yourself as accessibly as possible, then you are in a place where it's like, okay, now I can have fun and I don't need to go to open mics. So what I like to do now is just try to lean into things that I'm interested in and go have some life experience. There's too many people in comedy that just do comedy.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, it's not relatable. Like most people don't just like, their only desire is to go figure out how to get on stage every day. So your life experience becomes really narrowed.
Yeah.
And so that trip across the country, I went to 26 national parks. I went to 20 some states that I'd never been to before. I'd been to half of them, but I hadn't been to half of them. And having different experiences, I mean, there's three or four solid bits on that album that are from experiences from taking a time to get. I didn't do any comedy that whole time.
Wow.
And so I think it's about like living life and trying to find the thing that is like, what is accessible to everyone and what is something that I can bring someone to my level of like, here's an experience that I had and
yeah,
can you relate?
Yeah.
Let's laugh about it.
Right.
Well, that's the whole motivation for me.
And I think too, in these times, I think as things get a little bit rougher, we're kind of looking for the silly, you know, we're looking for the...
I'm hoping. I am getting a little, like, I'm getting a little worried if, like, in 2 years, people are going to be like, I don't even want to laugh anymore.
I know. Like, well, we're not going to do that. We need to laugh. And we got to go now. But I want, before we go,
because
I got a big red light flashing at me.
Totally.
Let's tell people one more time when the show is and how they can get tickets.
Yes, you should. If you want to laugh and enjoy my new hour of material, it's going to be this Thursday, February 6th at 7:30 at the Garland Theater. I would love for you to be there. Tickets are on sale on Eventbrite. If you went to Eventbrite and typed in Garland Comedy, it would probably take you there. My name is Jordan Cerminara, C-E-R-M-I-N-A-R-A. You can find me on social media at Handcut Comedy, and you can check out some of my comedy and the things that I'm working on at handcutcomedy.com. And you will find tickets through one of those avenues if you look hard enough.
Well, thank you, Jordan, so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here.
That sounds good. And you are listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane 88.1 and 92.3 FM.
I don't stay ugly, don't care to go. I'm home about it, just me and my radio. Ain't misbehaving, I'm saving my life.
Guess I'll just have to throw myself on Donald Trump's mercy, for I confess that I am a repeat violator of MAGA's high crime of DEI-ism. Diversity, equity, inclusion. Guilty on all counts. But it's not my fault. From childhood, I was fed a steady diet of that kind of all-in-this-together thinking by my parents, teachers, and ministers. So next thing you know, I was doing DEI on my own. Then, when I was elected to be Texas Agriculture Commissioner, I shamelessly promoted all three as agency goals, particularly for women and minorities who had long been excluded. But I now see that such egalitarian concepts are out of step with the moral precepts of Trumpocracy. Thus, I'm an outlaw. You might be one too, for the MAGA minority now ruling in Washington is thuggishly expunging DEI values from our schools, corporations, libraries, churches, etc. You have two choices, they bark, comply or be forced to comply. Sure enough, even corporate powerhouses like Amazon, Disney, Facebook, Target, and Walmart are sucking up to the new regime by cravenly surrendering DEI principles and promises without a fight. Well, they whine, we have no choice. But wait, this is America. The choice has always been clear. Don't just comply, defy. Even corporations can stand for the people's democratic principles, as Costco recently did. The popular retailer was assailed by a right-wing group demanding that shareholders terminate its DEI efforts. But Costco executives didn't cower. And guess what? 98% of Costco shareholders stood with them, emphatically endorsing diversity, equity, and inclusion as core American values. This is Jim Hightower saying, 98%, that, Mr. Trump, is a real mandate. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you subscribers to Jim Hightower's Lowdown on Substack. Find us at jimhightower.substack.com.
Hey, this is Ella.
This is Kaya.
And this is Meg, and we're Plum Vision.
And you're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane.
KYRS Medical Lake and K222BG Dartford, 88.1 FM and 92.3 FM, Thin Air Community Radio. The following program was pre-recorded.
Is Democracy Now.
China's running the Panama Canal. That was not given to China, that was given to Panama foolishly, but they violated the agreement, and we're going to take it back or something very powerful is going to happen.
President Trump has reiterated his threat to retake the Panama Canal after Marco Rubio visited Panama on his first foreign trip as Secretary of State. We'll go to Panama and then to Guatemala, where Rubio will be today. On Monday, Rubio met with El Salvador's authoritarian leader, who's offering to jail U.S. citizens for a fee and accept deportees from any country. We'll also look at Trump's plan to house as many as 30,000 immigrants at Guantanamo, the U.S. Navy base in Cuba. Then to Trump's threats to deport pro-Palestinian student protesters. In a recent executive order, Trump urged schools to, quote, monitor and report activities by alien students, unquote. We'll speak to a Cornell University graduate student who faced deportation last year after taking part in Gaza's solidarity protests.
My university, Cornell, was presented with a crossroads, and they failed with their attempts to see me deported. Now they have been presented with another crossroads,